listen to the address of Amilcar Cabral, who was then the leader of the liberation movement in Guinea-Bissau. He appealed to the UN for support of their armed struggle in Africa against the Portuguese government. And you may not believe it, but as a result of his appeal, the UN voted not only to recognize Amilcar Cabral's party as the only legitimate representative of the people whom the Portuguese pretend to rule, but they voiced their support, they voted their support for armed struggle against the Portuguese. This is a resolution which passed on the floor of the UN. You know who voted against that resolution? France, a former colonialist power. Britain, a former colonialist power. Portugal, South Africa, and one more country. I don't even have to tell you what the name of that country is.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Groundings Podcast. I am Devin Springer, your host, here with another episode that I'm really excited to record. We're going to be discussing Amilcar Cabral. Amilcar is an African revolutionary organizer, academic, writer, agronomist. He led a successful anti-colonial movement against the Portuguese in Guinea-Bissau, the Cape Verde Islands. But today we're going to talk a little bit about his philosophy, specifically his philosophy of culture, cultural liberation, and then we'll get into a few other topics as well that sort of arise naturally. And with me to discuss this is researcher, writer, Ziad Al-Nabalski. I actually came across his work because we're both publishing a book together, Keywords in Radical Philosophy and Education. And I was astonished with the depth and applicability of his writing on, you know, sort of philosophical questions that relate to liberation and Marxism, as well as many other areas. But before I continue to butcher an introduction of him, I'm going to let him go ahead and introduce himself. Ziad?
Hello, Devin. It's a great pleasure to be on this podcast. I'm a big fan of your podcast. So my name is Ziad Nabalsi. I'm a PhD student in Africana Studies. I also try to do organizing work in the region in upstate New York. So I mostly, in terms of research, I mostly work on modern African intellectual history, specifically modern African political philosophy and African Marxism. And I'm really happy to have a chance to discuss Cabral on your podcast.
Can you sort of give the listeners a sort of quick overview or bio of who Cabral was?
Of course. Cabral was born on September 12, 1924. Cabral is best known, I suppose, as the leader of the national liberation struggle that eventually led to the independence and unification for a while of Cape Verde, an archipelago of islands off the west coast of Africa, and Guinea-Bissau. Which both of these territories were under Portuguese colonial rule. And of course, Portuguese colonial rule was the last of the European colonial rules to be kicked out of Africa. So we're talking about struggles that extended into the 1970s. So colonialism in the former Portuguese colonies is quite recent, in the 70s, mid-70s even. So Cabral was born in Guinea-Bissau to Cape Verdean parents, you know, relatively privileged family, poor but educated. Cabral was always a student who academically excelled, and eventually he managed to get a scholarship in 1945 to go and study in Lisbon in Portugal. And of course, there were no universities in Cape Verde or Guinea-Bissau. So the only way for an African like Cabral to get secondary education was to try to get a scholarship to the metropole, in this case, Portugal. So he went and he studied agronomy. Cabral actually has an extensive corpus of writings on agronomy, which have not been translated into English. Cabral spent around 7 years in Lisbon. And there you can actually see him developing an identity, consciousness of his identity as an African, because Cape Verdeans, the way Portuguese colonial rule worked was, you know, Cape Verdeans were considered by the Portuguese to be somehow different from Africans from the mainland. They were given relatively privileged treatment, seen as Portuguese, which, again, even in this context, didn't really mean much in terms of providing services to them as citizens. So Cabral comes back from Portugal. He's radicalized politically to a certain extent by his experiences in Portugal. He comes back and he founds the PAIGC in 1956, becomes essentially the leader of the liberation struggle.
I want people listening to really get a grasp on the time frame and the dates that we're talking mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. Portuguese direct colonial rule. This was, mm-hmm. you know, 1956. This was when people's parents and grandparents mm-hmm. were young, right? So this wasn't hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note that, you know, when Cabral is assassinated in January of 1973, this is relatively recently. At that time, you know, a year after independence would be declared, but we're still talking mid-70s. So it's quite recent, quite contemporary almost.
Most of the time, actually, when we talk about African revolutionaries of the past century, many of them are just a few decades removed, right? Like this is Walter Rodney was 1980. You know, so this time period is contemptuous. There's an immediacy to its relevance, right? This is an archaic information. And it shows that the decolonial or anti-colonial struggle in Africa is still relatively young in the sense of organized movements. Of course, there's been revolts and uprisings for hundreds of years against colonial bodies, but in the sense of quote unquote alleged modernity, right? This is a relatively young struggle. You wrote a paper called Amilcar Cabral's Modernist Philosophy of Culture and Cultural Liberation, and you're making some pretty big arguments and claims, and you're actually challenging some Western interpretations of not just Cabral, but of African revolutionaries in general. I found the essay really intriguing and relevant and interesting, and I wanted to get into a discussion with you about it. Specifically, this notion, his notion of culture and culture as it relates to quote-unquote modernity. Can you sort of tell me a little bit about your approach to writing about this topic?
I would say in terms of methods, there are several ways of reading Cabral. So for a while, you know, in the literature on Cabral, which isn't that extensive, of course, and some of it is written in a kind of celebratory manner, you know, celebrating the life of Cabral. But even some of the writings that celebrate his life don't really go into depth in terms of explaining his thought. So, but there is some literature that tries to think of Cabral as a theoretician. And in reaction to that literature, more recent literature, so in particular, Patrick Chabal's book, and Patrick Chabal has written, I think, what is the only really extensive political biography of Cabral that's available in English, first published in 1983 and then reissued in 2003. So there is a reaction to reading Cabral as a theoretician, and it draws on certain presuppositions, I think, in African studies and the way African leaders of liberation struggles, who are also theoreticians, I mean, this is the whole point of my project, is to point out their status as theoreticians. But the reaction was to say, look, you know, you're sort of hoisting these theoretical interests and this systematic coherence onto people who weren't really that interested in developing, you know, a systematic theory. And I think, you know, when we look at the texts, of course, you know, Cabral is involved in a military struggle for liberation. So naturally, we can see that he doesn't have time to say, write one big, massive book that you can say this is, you know, Cabral's masterpiece. But my point is that when we look carefully at his writings, you'll see, you know, a coherent, systematic approach to questions of culture. And I call that a modernist philosophy of culture. So I think, obviously, you know, in terms of discourse about modernity and modernism, there are various ways to define it. I try to define it in philosophical terms as a normative framework. I identify three principles, the principle of subjectivity, which I render in terms of, you know, individual autonomy, placing value on individual autonomy and through that on collective autonomy of a people insofar as they come together and decide we want to govern ourselves. Of course, that's essentially the philosophical basis or justification for essentially all of the independence movements on the African continent and elsewhere during that time period. The second element, I would say, I frame it in terms of the centrality of reason. And by that, I mean, you know, this philosophical framework, this philosophical approach to questions of culture looks at cultural institutions and beliefs and asks, can they be rationally justified? So it doesn't seek to do away with them just for the sake of doing away with what is old, but it asks, can it be justified in relation to our struggles to this current historical juncture? If not, then we have to get rid of it. Obviously, Cabral always stressed that the PAIGC, the party which led the liberation struggle in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, that it must always struggle against what he called negative cultural forms that were harmful to people, to specific groups of people even, for example, women, without violence. So he emphasized persuasion. The third element is, I'd say, you know, a belief in progress in the sense that somebody who adopts this, what we can call modernist philosophy of culture, really looks towards the future when assessing current institutions. One is not obsessed with the return to the past. And I think this is really important because Cabral, you know, one of the slogans, if you will, that's associated with Cabral is, of course, the return to the source. One issue of his collected speeches is called the return to the source. And I think, obviously, Cabral was interested in a return to the source, but I would make a conceptual distinction between returning to the source and returning to the past. Cabral was never about returning to the past.
So essentially, you're quantifying what you mean when you say a modernist, the very term modernist or modernity, right? You're sort of quantifying or qualifying, I should say,
right? Yeah.
What that means, yes. Right? And you believe that Cabral worked within similar qualifications for his conception of culture. Am I correct?
Right, yes.
An interesting dynamic here is the relationship of culture within a colonized body of people. As you've mentioned, and you mentioned your essay, and Cabral writes about the relationship between culture, sort of a quote-unquote native culture, and the culture of a colonizing body, in this case, the Portuguese. Does this framework allow us to view that relationship or even that contradiction? And I guess, what does Cabral have to say about that?
I think Cabral is very clear that one way in which colonialism worked was through what he called, you know, the negation of the culture of the colonized people. So it's a negation in various ways, you know. So negation in terms of trying to undermine these cultural institutions which exist in the colonized society, which can be used in order to resist colonialism and the colonial state apparatus. But also one way in which it negates the culture, in which colonialism negates the culture of the colonized, is that it essentially attempts to ossify it. So Cabral always says, look, colonialism, contrary to the propaganda of the Portuguese state apparatus and, you know, the state apparatus associated with colonialism anywhere, essentially, this idea that, you know, look, colonialism brought Africans into history, that African societies were static with no internal principle of motion, you know, basically, obviously, people live and die and so on, but it's a kind of cyclical existence. And that what colonialism did was that it sort of disrupted these static institutions and essentially led to a kind of dynamism in African societies. So Cabral completely disagrees with this claim. Cabral thinks that far from doing that, colonialism actually arrested the historical development of the colonized peoples. So here you can say also, you can say that there is this correspondence or agreement with between Cabral and people, you know, who worked on theories of underdevelopment, you know, like André Gunder Frank, Samir Amin, Walter Rodney, mentioned him, of course. So Cabral says, look, if you also look at Portuguese policy towards the colonized peoples in Guinea-Bissau, you'll see that the Portuguese even sometimes attempted to reinforce the cultural authority of chiefs in socially stratified societies in Guinea-Bissau, such as Kola society. They attempted to reinforce their cultural authority in order to use them as essentially a co-opted elite that they can use to govern and to extract resources and surplus from those societies. Cabral doesn't simplify the relationship between colonialism and cultural domination. Sometimes it takes the form of preserving indigenous culture, but preserving it without life, preserving it in a fossilized form. And Cabral thought that was quite harmful. And sometimes, obviously, it attempts to negate elements, like I said, that are potential tools or instruments of resistance.
And I like that you noted the connection between Cabral's writings on culture and cultural erosion that took place through colonialism and theorists of underdevelopment. I know this is a central theme in many sections of Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, in detailing the ways in which the claim and the myth that colonialism brought quote-unquote infrastructure, or the claim it brought culture or industrialization or whatever it may be, there's a number of claims that colonialism was the bringer of good to the people of Africa. He spends a lot of time dispelling these myths and lies, really. And it's fascinating that the experience of colonialism as experienced by Walter Rodney or by Cabral or by Fanon or by Steve Biko, even, they all lead to these similar conclusions. So when it comes to discussions of culture or local society, there's often similar conclusions that are arrived at.
Right, and I'm really happy that you want to emphasize this connection between Cabral's theory or philosophy of culture and theories of underdevelopment or the development of underdevelopment, because Cabral also, you know, he ties the question of culture to material conditions, and here, you know, we can see the influence of some variant or some reinterpretation of historical materialism on Cabral, because Cabral obviously thought that culture was a way in which people organized their interactions with one another, and it's a way in which people organized and understood their relations to nature. And obviously you can see that this conception of culture ties culture to, you know, the level of the development of productive forces. It ties it to, you know, what Marxists call relations of production. And Cabral really uses that to do something interesting. He says, look, some people, and he doesn't mention people here by name. Cabral was not somebody who wished to antagonize others, but for, you know, we can see him as criticizing Leopold Senghor's negritude, the concept of negritude, or a certain interpretation of it. So Senghor, of course, was the first president of Senegal post-independence. But, you know, one way in which to characterize Senghor is to say that he wasn't very keen on supporting armed liberation movements in neighboring countries. So the PAIGC, for example, Cabral's party, found it quite difficult to establish a base in Senegal. And their base of operations was, of course, in Conakry, in Guinea-Conakry, neighboring Guinea-Conakry, which was a beacon of progressive policies under the leadership of Sékou Touré. So Cabral uses this materialist, if you like, conception of culture to say that, and here I actually have a quote from him. So he says, a profound analysis of cultural reality removes the supposition that there can be continental or racial cultures, in the same way that from the economic and political point of view, one can note the existence of various Africas, so there are also various African cultures. And here the critique is directed at Senghor's concept of negritude, which was a concept that some critics at least say was drawn from colonialist anthropology. And it developed this essentialized view of African cultures, a kind of monolithic view of African culture, which Cabral was critical of, because Cabral says, look, you know, if you look at African history, we've had, you know, tributary empires like the Malayan Empire in the 13th century, which also ruled a part of what is today Guinea-Bissau. And we've had a small communal rural societies. But there's this tremendous variation in terms of modes of production in African history. So we can't, you know, speak of African history and just refer to this kind of communitarian ethos as what is essential about African culture or African history.
The relationship between culture and conceptions of culture and modes of production and development is grossly underlooked and underestablished. And it reminds me of Walter Rodney's when he said that a culture is a total way of life. It encompasses, right. He describes that culture encompasses not just dance and cuisine, but also your mm-hmm. labor and your labor relations, right?
Right, absolutely.
And even the normalization of a type of labor or labor in society is all encompassed within a culture. And not to get too abstract, but, we have what some have called the dominance of pop culture within the political mm-hmm. sphere in the West, right? And these lessons, I'm glad we're having this conversation because I hope that there can be sort of a deepening between the dialogue of the two realms. Now, I wanted to get into a part of your essay in which you sort of push back and critique some Western academic, I guess I'll say, criticism of Cabral. I mean, in my opinion, mm-hmm. it's almost, the wording is almost racist, which is used in describing Cabral. So there's Patrick Chabal who argues that, quote, Cabral was primarily a man of action, and that, quote, the majority of his writings are party documents and they reflect the very specific purpose and audience for which they're intended. It is neither useful nor legitimate to claim, as some analysts have, that Cabral's writings form a systematic or sufficient body of ideas. Of course, he also claims that Cabral was loath to commit himself to any ideology or theory. So these are, to me, I read these as descriptions of Cabral and Cabral's work that are thinly true, but to me, largely editorialized in the sense mm-hmm. that it's almost a projection and it's almost a disparaging of Cabral while describing him or his ideology.
Right. So I think Patrick Chabal did a lot of research for his book on Cabral. And actually, I think Chabal is misled by a kind of Eurocentrism that's really more clearly manifest in the writings of somebody who influenced Chabal, an Africanist called Christopher Clapham, who tried to argue that, look, we look at the writings of African political leaders in the period of the liberation struggles. Well, these writings basically consist of ideas that, and here I'm going to quote him, are plucked by any African politician from there he breathes and marshaled to fit his own situation and inclinations, the audience he is facing, and the purposes he wants to achieve. So I think Clapham is much more condescending than Chabal is. I think Chabal is just misled, which also, it's mm-hmm. it's a kind of manifestation of Eurocentrism in Chabal's own outlook. Because Chabal, he loves Cabral. He thinks Cabral is the leader of what he calls the most successful liberation movement in, to use his words, sub-Saharan Africa. And he thinks that Cabral is this unique leader. But even then, he doesn't really see him as a theorist. And he thinks that if we take a look at, what he's saying, okay, we can agree, that it is not a self-sufficient body of ideas. But I only agree with that because nobody of ideas is self-sufficient. You obviously draw on your context, on your readings, and so on. But it is systematic. This is where I disagree with him. It is systematic in the sense that everything he says regarding culture can be more or less deduced from what I talked about earlier, from his commitment to a modernist philosophy of culture. And here is, my disagreement with Chabal.
I want people to understand the weight of this conversation. We're dealing with two Western scholars who through, one of them with love and admiration for Cabral, who is still so steeped in a Eurocentric positioning, mm-hmm. can still be disparaging of him. I mean, love, when misguided or misframed, can still be harmful to someone's legacy.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. That's a great way of putting it because, and here I think we can talk about the relevance of engaging, say, in in-depth studies of Cabral or Nkrumah or anybody else. Sometimes you see those people and we have t-shirts with their faces on it and so on. But, if you don't really engage with the work, you can just fall back into this Eurocentric view where, they are heroes, they are, as Chabal puts it, men of action and so on, but they're not really thinkers. And then we again have this kind of division of labor between theorists from what we can call the global north and theorists from what we can call the global south, where, the north is going to provide the theories. Theorists scientists or thinkers from the South are basically supposed to provide the data, or, you know, in the best case scenario, just the application of the theory, but they're not really supposed to develop their own theoretical output. And I think that's a really good point.
And I think that what's almost laughable about the assumption that Cabral was just a, quote, man of action and not a theorist is that that's almost slavery language, right? that Black people are laborers and they're people of action and they're workers. They're not thinkers. I mean, that even right. if that's yeah, not absolutely. The intention, yeah. that yeah. that sort yeah. of legacy of a statement like that cannot be ignored. I mean, I'm going to reread Clapham's statement that he says, you know, that African political leaders in the period of the liberation struggles consist of ideas that are, quote, plucked by any African politician from the air he breathes and marshaled to fit his own situation and inclinations, the audience he is facing, and the purposes he wants to achieve. You described it as condescending earlier, and I think that's a nice description of that. So it's not only in regards to Cabral, but in African studies in general, actually. This is a sort of heavy trend of writers and academics and scholars and researchers placing these projections onto African leaders and revolutionaries. This is actually how canons are constructed, even.
Right, absolutely.
When you think of different disciplines having a canon of literature, which mm-hmm. is almost required reading for that discipline, right? And these are the people who often are gatekeepers of those canons. So this is emblematic of a much larger and a very problematic trend, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you brought up the issue of canon formation, because, you know, so, okay, I concede that if somebody picks up, say, the volume that was put out by the Monthly Review Press, Unity and Struggle, Speeches and Writings of Amilcar Cabral, so if somebody picks it up with no background information and with the framework that's provided by our culture in North America, which is a Eurocentric framework, an Eurocentric way of looking at intellectual history, maybe they will read it and say, okay, I don't see much theorization here. But here is the thing, you know, I mean, if we look at texts that are taught, say, in political philosophy, they are taken to be clearly philosophy because you have all of this interpretive apparatus, right? You know, people writing commentaries on commentaries, you know, so second order commentaries and all of that stuff. So if you abstract from all of that and you pick up, you know, classic texts of political philosophy or something like that, or political theory, it is, again, not clear that somebody will have an easy time in terms of categorizing it or understanding it or understanding the main claims. So I think what's happening is that people forget what goes into forming the canon in terms of all the effort that people put in, you know, in terms of, say, you know, we can look at like the interpretation of Marx, for example, you know. If we didn't have this interpretive apparatus and all of these writings and commentaries and so on, our encounter with the text will be quite different.
It reminds me of when I was speaking with Patricia Rodney, Dr. Patricia Rodney, actually, the wife of Walter Rodney, and she described to me how he was fluent in English and Spanish, but upon entering his graduate work, taught himself Portuguese and Italian and even a functioning sort of working proficiency in German, because he didn't want to have to rely on bourgeois interpretations and translations of colonial texts and documents. These are sort of levels that have to be taken in order to really persevere and have your work, I guess, be a critical body. Many of the people who are established in the African studies canon are not people who did that kind of work. They did sort of what you're saying, right? They're interpreting interpretations. They're responding to responses. They're challenging other people's critique of someone else, of someone else, of someone else. So this is a very big question. And it isn't purely academic either, right? There's the notion of a canon, of a body of work, which is foundational to a discipline or study. We can see that also, I mean, you can look at precedent in workplaces of certain labor. You can look at that in culture. There's sort of the quote unquote canon of culture, right? And so this is a very prescient and, to me, relevant discussion. And we might have gotten a little bit off topic, but I think it falls into this idea that the legacy of Cabral, it may be understudied, and that could actually be a good thing. I was speaking with a friend of mine recently, And he said he thinks it's a good thing, actually, that Walter Rodney hasn't been, quote unquote, mainstreamed in the way that someone like Malcolm X has, because that means his legacy is still largely intact and still largely preserved by the family. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that when it, in regards to the legacy of Cabral.
Right. So I think that's a really good question, because, you know, on the one hand, obviously, somebody might be interested in say, bringing Cabral into a canon, you know, whatever canon. One is interested in maybe a canon of political theory, canon of political philosophy, social theory, and so on. But like you said, there is the issue of, you know, how do we take advantage, obviously, of these resources that are that will become available for the study of Cabral if he's taking seriously in academic institutions, while on the other hand, preserving his radical radical and revolutionary legacy. So it's always a difficult question, I think, because obviously there is, you know, so I my personal view on this is that there is, you know, a kind of bourgeois reactionary way to teach any text. If you assimilate it in a certain way, in a certain curriculum, you know, there is definitely a bourgeois way to teach Karl Marx, for example. So Karl Marx enters, you know, the canon of sociology after the 60s and so on. But he enters as a kind of foil to Max Weber or whatever. So it would be, I think, a shame if something like that happens to Cabral. He enters the canon and he's kind of neutralized in a certain way. So obviously, you know, this is a really difficult topic. You know, we can spend an hour talking about this, but I think it's definitely worth thinking about balancing, you know, the resources that we'll have in terms of finding out more about Cabral's life, funds to do archival research and so on, funds to have conferences on Cabral. But then there is the issue of accessibility as well, you know, who has access to this knowledge that is generated on Cabral if we do it in an academic setting.
Mm-hmm. Before we sort of move on to another angle of discussion, specifically Cabral as it relates to historical materialism, I wanted to get you to speak about one more part, I guess maybe two more parts of your essay.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of them is sort of Cabral's conception of identity and mm-hmm. his way of imploring that, which you speak of a little bit. And I found that interesting because this sort of term of quote-unquote identity is so prescient in today's popular discourse. We have the identitization of movements now where we have identity-based movements versus like class or liberation-based movements. So I just found his conception and discussion of identity and really identity as this sort of anti or non-essentialist construction was really important. So can you just sort of break that down a little bit for the listeners?
One way in which we can understand his conception of identity is to say, so he draws on this commitment to autonomy, especially in relation to history, and says, okay, you know, a modernist view, what would a modernist view of history look like? And it's essentially a view of history where, you know, people make their own history, obviously not under conditions of their choosing, as Marx would remind us, and as Cabral would agree, of course, there are material constraints and so on. But for Cabral, you know, you're free when you start making your own history, in the sense of you decide what to do with your life. You decide collectively as a society, how are we going to organize production, redistribution, and so on. And Cabral also points out that cultural identity is a function of history. So this leads him to a view of cultural identity as, you know, a kind of what I call a historicized view, in the sense that cultural identity changes as a function of time. So it has always changed as a function of time. But I think what's distinctive about a kind of active modernist approach to cultural identity is that the people who embrace this approach consciously try to change their cultural identity as a function of time. They are aware of the factors that lead to changes in cultural identity, and they choose what changes to bring about, what changes to reject, what to preserve, what not to preserve. So cultural liberation for Cabral is not really about cultural preservation. It's not about preserving cultural institutes. We can preserve them if we collectively agree that they are beneficial to us, that they do not contradict any other principles that we adhere to. But cultural liberation is more about the autonomy of choosing your own history. So this leads Cabral to say things like, he's critical, for example, of the idea that in order to be a real Cape Verdean or a real Bissau Guinean, you have to know an indigenous language like Balanta, for example. Cabral says, no, you know, it's not a sufficient condition, first, because he gives several examples of people who knew these languages but collaborated with the Portuguese. So Cabral says those individuals, you know, he makes a distinction between somebody was what he calls a member of the population. So you're a member of the population, say, if you're born in Guinea-Bissau, you know, there's nothing. That's just a brute fact, you know, a brute historical accident. And being a member of the people, being of the people means that, you know, you are committed to their struggle and so on. And he also says knowing, you know, a language like Balanta, for example, is not a necessary condition because you have people who only spoke Creole and Portuguese, but who were leading members of the PAIGC and contributed to the people's struggle for liberation. And here what's really significant about this, I think, is that Cabral undermines some ideas of identity that are prevalent even today. This idea that, you know, identity is something that has to do with a cluster of properties that people have, and those properties are kind of trans-historical, you know, they don't change across historical epochs or as a function of time. So for Cabral, obviously, this is, well, it's, you know, he rejects it because, first of all, it's false. Cultural identity, like we said, changes as a function of time. But second, it also plays into the hands of the discourse of oppressors, because one way in which the oppressed are depicted by their oppressors is as having a kind of unchangeable essence, as having something really authentic, you know, authentic about them in a kind of colonial racist sense. And obviously this was happening in the context of Portuguese colonial rule, you know. Somebody like Cabral, you know, rejected colonialism and so on. He was considered an example of an assimilado, you know, they use that term, assimilado, who suffered from a kind of neurotic disorder as a result of these, you know, progressive quote unquote European influences on his African identity. So they had a very static conception of what it is to be African, a very condescending, racist view of what it is to be African. And Cabral is obviously trying to undermine this.
A few months ago, Amilcar Cabral was ruthlessly assassinated by agents of Portuguese colonialism, because he and his movement were becoming far too dangerous, far too great a threat to Portuguese colonialism and to the imperialist hold over Africa in general. And of course, the death of Cabral was a very serious setback for the national liberation movement. In the first place, for the movement in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, but also for the national liberation movements throughout Africa, in Mozambique, in Angola, in Zimbabwe, and throughout the continent where there continues to be colonialist domination. Yet, those of us who are involved in the global battle against imperialism know that such setbacks are only temporary. They are not permanent defeats, because they cannot halt the tide of resistance. The liberation struggle in Guinea-Bissau continues to rage on and will ultimately defeat Portuguese colonialism.
So his view of culture, for example, when he says culture is the dynamic synthesis of the material and intellectual reality of society and expresses relation both between man and nature, as well as between the different groups of men within the same society. It is, as you describe, an anti-essentialist view of identity, wherein identity is not made some immutable, concrete, or existing outside of the class structure in some way, right? Like, it is a very almost malleable structure, right? Culture, and one that interacts with the sort of social structures and structures of society around it, and class structures, as well as, of course, race. This is, for him, the construction of identity, of an African identity. And I think at the time of writing this, when the Negritude movement, as you mentioned earlier, was still prominent in discussion, whereas today many people have never even heard of the Negritude movement. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the time, this was The Negritude movement, for those who are unaware, was this movement which sought to, it's almost hard to explain actually, but it was a frame of critique. It was also an intellectual framework. It was a literary theory that sought to see an African identity or a Black consciousness. And many would say that it was reductionist in a sense, but people like Aimé Césaire and Senghor, as you mentioned earlier, were large parts of that. Frantz Fanon even referenced Negritude very often throughout his writing. Some people say it inspired the Black is Beautiful movement in the U.S.
Right.
So at the time of these movements, the Black is Beautiful, Negritude, the quote-unquote Pan-African identity birthing or existing sort of openly and popularly, him, I think that him writing this about culture and non-essentializing culture might have been even controversial, but was just very relevant to the time of discussion. And the fact that it feels relevant again today, to me, shows just almost a rebirth of that Negritude attitude and the counter sort of arguments to it, right?
That's definitely a good point, because Cabral, and like I said, Cabral doesn't mention people by name because, like, he had this diplomatic approach to these debates. But I think one thing that Cabral benefited from is the fact that Portuguese colonialism lasted for so long. I mean, this might seem paradoxical, but what I mean by that is that when the PAIGC began armed struggle in the early 60s, they adopt the strategy of armed struggle. And initially, actually, they didn't adopt the strategy. We can talk about this, why they had to change their approach after 1959 and so on. But when he was writing this, Cabral had already seen the kind of neocolonial impasse that afflicted many African countries after they had attained independence. So, for example, in Cabral's writings, we see an analysis of the causes that led to the coup d'etat that deposed Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. So Cabral, you know, is able to sort of identify the various faults that existed in previous waves of African liberation movements, because, you know, he's writing in the late 60s, so he sees all of these developments happening, writing late 60s, early 70s. So he benefits from this analysis, you know, and he says, you know, when we look at the various liberation movements on the African continent and their fate and so on, we see, and I quote him here, there is an ideological deficiency, not to say the total lack of ideology on the part of the liberation movements, which is basically explained by ignorance of the historical reality which these movements aspire to transform, constitutes one of the greatest weaknesses, if not the greatest weakness, of our struggle against imperialism. So he's analyzing the weaknesses of other liberation movements who had already, you know, been able to essentially achieve a kind of independence, of course, a juridical independence, perhaps not a full independence, but he benefits from this in a sense.
In this regard, Cabral, I think that he's very similar to Nkrumah in the, there's a sort of anti-dogmatist, right? He's anti-dogmatic, I think, in a lot of his work. For example, in Nkrumah in 1967, he wrote an essay titled African Socialism Revisited. And I'm not sure if you've read it, and I'll link it in the description of this episode for listeners who are interested. But he's actually pushing back a little bit against the term, quote unquote, African socialism. He says that, and I'm summarizing here, but it's a generalization, and it's a sort of almost a dogmatic generalization. And he asked the question of, like, what are the qualifications for this? And what does this even mean? Especially, you know, if you consider that socialism is something that is of and created and sustained through specific contexts and conditions where it arises. Of course, you can't have a generalized, quote unquote, African socialism for the largest continent on Earth. I think it's interesting. He even says at one point, quote, today, the phrase African socialism seems to espouse the view that the traditional African society was a classless society imbued with the spirit of humanism, to express a nostalgia for that spirit. Such a conception of socialism makes a fetish of the communal African society. And then he later says, colonialism deserves to be blamed for many ills in Africa, but surely it was not preceded by an African golden age or paradise. So what he's saying is that we don't need nostalgia to be anti-colonial. He's saying that, quote unquote, pre-colonial societies, maybe there were classless and stateless societies, or there were quote unquote communal societies, but we don't have to be fetishistic about them, and we don't have to be reductionist in the way we speak about them. There could have still been varying degrees of social or political or even economic disparities that existed. So to me, this is a very anti-dogmatic position to take. And again, at the time, I think it was probably received with some controversy as the term African socialism continued to become more and more popular. With Cabral, in regards to the Portuguese language, he, I think, also takes a very anti-dogmatic approach, wherein there is the idea that anything Portuguese, anything colonial has to go. And in one sense, that is extremely true. But on the other sense, he, and you discussed this in your essay, he demonstrates why just a language alone is not a determinant of someone's commitment to the to decolonization struggles. There could be class traitors and compromisers who speak the indigenous languages of Guinea-Bissau or Cape Verde, and there could be class traders who speak Portuguese and vice versa, right? So I think Cabral was a man who was not dogmatic, and I'm not sure your take on that. Maybe you see him as the opposite. Maybe you think he is dogmatic. I guess I shouldn't project that onto you.
No. I think that's a very accurate characterization of Cabral, because Cabral is always emphasizing that, you know, the party, they have to study the concrete reality of Guinea-Bissau. So he says, of course, you know, he says, we learn, you know, by reading about other revolutions, we learn by reading various theorists and so on, but we do not dogmatically apply what we learn from them, because obviously every concrete situation has something specific about it that, you know, makes it different from other situations. So I think this emphasis on looking at concrete reality is really important. And Cabral, you know, one of the fascinating things about Cabral is when he comes back from Portugal, so he's given a position as an agronomist in a Portuguese research station in Guinea-Bissau, and he's given this assignment to essentially carry out an agricultural census of Guinea-Bissau, which had never been done before. So here's the thing. So Cabral takes on this project in 1953. So he travels about 60,000 kilometers overall in terms of moving around to various villages and so on and interviewing peasants. And he interviews, and obviously along with a team of research assistants, he interviews 2,248 peasants. So he had a really well-developed and intimate knowledge of conditions in Guinea-Bissau. I think that obviously came into use when he started the armed struggle for liberation, because he had such a detailed knowledge of various social formations in Guinea-Bissau, which is something that perhaps other leaders who carried out their agitation primarily in the colonial capitals did not have. You know, they did not have this detailed knowledge of rural conditions. And one more thing, I think that the issue of African socialism is really interesting. I mean, it's interesting that you mention Kwame Nkrumah's critique of African socialism, because Cabral doesn't explicitly critique African socialism, but it's clear that, you know, what he says is incompatible with some of the key tenets of African socialism. Because like you said, and I think you put it really well when you said, you know, you don't need nostalgia to be anti-colonial. For Cabral, you know, anti-colonialism stems from a commitment to autonomy. It stems from a commitment to, you know, providing a better future for his people. It has nothing to do with the past, of course. It's not about restoring the past. Maybe you draw strength from the past if there are positive elements from the past, but you never seek to return to the past. Because Cabral was conscious of the fact that even in societies where you had this egalitarian structure, this was also the expression of, you know, the fact that the forces of production were not sufficiently developed to create sustained surplus. So there was a kind of equality, but equality in kind of material deprivation, as a notable critic of African socialism, Abdurrahman Muhammad Babu, said, you know, African socialists, they want to, you know, take us back to the era of equality, but equality in terms of material deprivation, which obviously is not what a modern socialist wants.
Now, switching a little bit over, we've spoken of Cabral largely, I think, actually, in Marxist terms and terminology in this discussion, that could be because of mine and your sort of political orientations. I think it's also because of Cabral's thought. to me, Cabral was very formulaic in all of his writing as well as his action. And it's good to examine that. And I think that your essay, Cabral's Theory of History Against the Reduction of Historical Materialism to a Theory of Class Struggle, you're placing Cabral very firmly in a very important conversation. Now, this is a essay that some might say is very academic. It's filled with lots of Marxist language and quote-unquote academic language. But I want us to take a second to sort of break down some of the arguments you're making in here and to discuss this. And for listeners who are unaware, Cabral actually never called himself, to my knowledge, a Marxist. He was a socialist and he was a materialist. And many would, or I should say, I have heard many say his hesitancy to label himself ideologically stems from the sort of Red Scare, eventual Cold War era that they were in. But that's a whole nother conversation, I guess, for another day. So, Ziad, can you tell me a little bit about this essay and what you're trying to discuss in this essay and just a brief introduction?
So this is an unpublished essay, so parts of it were presented in a conference. So my aim in this essay was basically to show that there is a sense in which we can speak of Cabral as a Marxist, despite the fact that, as you noted, Cabral never called himself a Marxist. And actually, I have the quote in front of me. So this is from an interview in London when he was asked whether he's a Marxist. So I quote, "If you decide it's Marxism, tell everyone that it is Marxism. If you decide that it's not Marxism, tell everyone it's not Marxism. But labels are your affair." And I think you've alluded to the Cold War context. And I think that's helpful in explaining why Cabral is hesitant to come out as a Marxist. I think, you know, one aspect is the PAIGC had really good diplomatic relations with countries that were, you know, we can call them social democratic countries, so Scandinavian countries like Sweden, which provided a lot of aid to the PAIGC. But obviously also the Soviet Union and East Germany provided a lot of aid as well. And just as a side note, the PAIGC's policy with respect to the question of aid and so on was really interesting because they refused any kind of aid that came with political commitments in the sense that they didn't want the supplier of aid to dictate to them their policies. They also refused aid programs that didn't fit with their development plans. So this is a really interesting point about the way in which they managed to preserve some level of autonomy. So back to the question of Cabral and Marxism. So I think Cabral does adopt historical materialism as a theory for interpreting history. And I think he is, in a speech that he gave in Havana, so in the first Tricontinental, which was held in Havana in January of 1966, speech that focused on the question of the relevance of historical materialism to the context of liberation struggles in what is called the Global South. Cabral tries to figure out, okay, so if we have this kind of narrow view as of a theory of historical materialism as essentially a theory of class struggle, what happens to societies where, you know, class formations were not sufficiently salient at certain points in their history? And I think he's worried here about saying, okay, look, class struggle is the motor of human history without qualifications. You know, we just say that. But then what happens to societies that didn't have classes? So Cabral thinks that at least some societies in Guinea-Bissau did not have well-developed class formations. But note, he doesn't think that this is true of all African societies, and it's not true of all societies in Guinea-Bissau. So Fula society would be a counterexample. So Cabral is saying, if we just look at the issue of class struggles, we will essentially be saying that those people without classes are essentially somehow outside history, which of course is the colonialist view of African history to some extent. So that's a brief introduction.
For some people, this might sound a little bit foreign, the notion of class struggle being related to the existence of a people's history. The phrasing might seem awkward to some who are unfamiliar with such Marxist terms, but it's very sort of simple in the way that I think you've broken it down. And I implore anyone listening, by the way, at any point throughout this episode who has a question or doesn't understand something to please tweet at me or Ziad and we can definitely explain it. And our Twitters, I will link them in the bio. of the description of the episode. What you're saying is, if people have a reductionist view of the Marxist conception of history being only related to class struggle in the orthodox sense, then societies without class formation would therefore have no history. And this is what you've essentially just explained.
Right. And I think, you know, you brought up a really excellent point about, it sounds really weird to say that there are societies without history. So I think we should be clear that here we're not talking about whether, you know, peoples without classes or without well-developed class formations have had a past. Obviously, even in this view, where class struggle is the motor of history, of historical transformations, yes, you know, somebody who adopts that view will say, of course, they have a past, but it's just that nothing really happens in that history, in that past. It's just a kind of static, undynamic past, a cyclical past, so societies, you know, reproducing themselves, but basically with the same structure, and there are no qualitative transformations in those societies. So Cabral wants to argue, I think, against that.
And I would argue against it as well, because I think it is, once again, a Eurocentric way of conceptualizing history and a Eurocentric way of reading Marx himself. And I think you'd actually argue similarly to that, by Cabral challenging this, he's actually aligning himself more closely with the Marx and sort of the original conception of all history is through class struggle, right? So...
Right. And just a brief follow-up. I think that view of historical materialism as just a theory of class struggle, essentially a kind of unorthodox view, right? So I'd say it's a kind of deviation, as you will, or revisionism in the negative sense of that word, the word that some Marxists use it in relation to Marxist theory.
Can you define, when you say historical materialism, can you define what you mean by that?
Right, so that's not an easy question, but I'll try. So
I know.
So in the context of this essay, I'm just interested in using the word historical materialism to refer to what people identify as the Marxist theory of social change or social transformation. We can also frame it in terms of, you know, the Marxist theory of historical change, so how historical change occurs. Basically, yeah, so that's my... very simple usage of the term, I'd say.
That history is a lineage of material realities and material changes rather than ideas, mm-hmm. which would be the sort of bourgeois conception of history, I believe.
Right. So historical materialism would definitely take into consideration culture. I mean, of course, Cabral was, like, you know, we were talking earlier, Cabral was very interested in developing theories of culture. But historical materialism would say that culture is conditioned by material constraints. So we can just talk about culture in the abstract without looking at, you know, the ways in which people, you know, interact with their environment to sustain themselves, the way in which people use whatever means they have available to reproduce their societies and so on, and the means by which, you know, they cooperate in order to get resources from their environments and so on.
And in a sense, we can put it in very basic terms that culture exists in regards with thoughts and ideas as well, which would be in the superstructure, which is in turn affected by the material base. Essentially, the material conditions are what provide thought and theory and culture and reason, quote unquote. Right. So. This is the conversation, which, again, as you said, Cabral doesn't mention names, but this is a very Marxist conversation, which Cabral is interjecting himself in the sort of history of people and development and these things. Cabral is interjecting himself in this, and he's creating an intervention, a moment of intervention for his people, but the people of Africa. There's even a quote you use where he says, quote, "It would also be to consider, and this we refuse to accept, that various human groups in Africa, Asia, and Latin America were living without history or outside of history at the moment when they were subjected to the yoke of imperialism." He's essentially saying that the argument, this dogmatic argument, would assume that these people, their history is only the history of colonialism and imperialism, right? That's actually the moment at which their history or their development, quote unquote, started and began. And now when he puts it like that, and when you see that, then you see why that is a problematic in Western Eurocentric conception of historical materialism and class struggle.
And I think his approach to historical materialism is, obviously, he doesn't abandon the significance of classes. He thinks they're important, but in societies, in specific historical periods where class formations were not well developed, he says, you know, we have to bring in, he stresses the concept of a mode of production. So a mode of, Cabral defines the mode of production of a given society as the combination of productive forces and the system of ownership that is characteristic of a given social formation or society at a certain point in time. So this is a pretty standard Marxist definition of a mode of production. And the point here is, you know, the key point is that the mode of production interpretation of historical materialism is more appropriate for explaining the history of societies without classes. Since while it is true that not all human societies have historically had classes or social stratification along class lines, it is nonetheless true that all human societies have had to produce, by produce we mean, you know, work in a cooperative manner on nature in order to sustain themselves. It is also true that in all societies one can identify relations of production insofar as one can identify relations of control over labor power, productive forces, and the fruits of production. So not all relations of production are class relations. I think that's one of the key points.
In another section of the essay, you sort of discuss Cabral's anti-Eurocentric Marxism against, quote, political Marxism. We won't go too deep into it because I know this essay isn't released yet and we've been speaking for over an hour now, so I don't want the listeners to doze off. But I think it's a very important pushback and intervention that Cabral is making here, and the way that you contextualize it, I think it's a very important read for many Western European Marxists, I guess is what I'm saying. But you're actually arguing that Cabral, you say, quote, Cabral had a better understanding of the internal logical structure of a historical materialism as a theory of history than those who asserted that, quote, the motive force of history is the class struggle without any qualifications. What you're saying is that Cabral, he works within qualifications discussing historical materialism as a theory of history. So he's not taking this statement at face value dogmatically. He's actually working within the qualifications, the same qualifications as Marx and Engels, actually. And he's saying that the Eurocentric Marxists of the strain of quote-unquote political Marxism are actually not working within a series of qualifications. Is that correct?
Right, in the sense of not taking into account the concrete reality which the theory is supposed to explain. So in this respect, Cabral maintains his independence as a thinker. You know, he always, you know, he never takes something on just because whatever some, you know, European Marxist party said that this is the correct way to do things, this is the correct way to explain things. He never takes it on uncritically. And I think this is a really important point because I can see that one hesitation that motivates people who say, okay, look, Cabral never said he was a Marxist, therefore he's not a Marxist. That's the end of the story, is that they're afraid that if we say that Cabral is a Marxist, then we're sort of saying, well, that means his thought is kind of derivative from, that it is derived in a kind of uncritical way from European Marxists, specifically Eurocentric Marxists, obviously, because you can be a European Marxist without being a Eurocentric Marxist. My aim is to say, okay, look, he takes on Marxism and its theoretical apparatus, but he never does so uncritically. For him, the test of any theory is, you know, the concrete reality that it has to explain. If it doesn't explain it, then Cabral would just abandon it. That's how his primary commitment is to understanding his own society in order to change it for the better. And obviously, one key step along that path is to liberate it from Portuguese colonialism.
Another interesting thing that you noted in your essay is actually the emergence of this quote-unquote political Marxism. But even before then, you discuss, I'm just going to read this quote real quick. You say, political Marxism is Eurocentric in two ways. The first is the manner in which capitalism is seen to emerge in Europe through purely European developments. And then you say, the second way is the fact that the adherents of political Marxism essentially write the history of the world as a whole as if non-Europeans living in what Cabral would call horizontal societies were outside of history. So essentially, this argument, it shuts out people who lived in classless societies or quote-unquote pre-colonial societies or communal societies. It shuts them out from the theory of history, from the world history. And you can, once again, as we've discussed Eurocentrism often, you can obviously see the Eurocentric nature of that. And you discussed the emergence of this viewpoint, and its time of emergence was actually sort of a counteraction to the third world Marxism, which was rising, right? And that to me is important to note, that at the time when, and you have a brilliant quote in your essay about it, but at the time when people like Che Guevara and Mao and Nkrumah and Fanon were dominating theories of revolution and of Marxism, and you had the Vietnam War, Europe was displaced from the center. So Europe was no longer what was centered in discussions of Marxism and revolution and development and class struggle. And we now have that decentering of Europe. And that, I think, maybe upset many European Marxists. And then we see this reemergence of a quote-unquote political Marxism, which seeks to recenter it.
Right. And I just say that the credit for this analysis, I obviously derive it, like you see, the quotation comes from an essay by Jim Blout, who was a Marxist geographer. And I think this essay is posted on his website. So I can send you the link and people can check it out. It's a critique of Robert Brenner, so the founder of political Marxism. It's called Robert Brenner in the Tunnel of Time. And I think it's a really great piece. So I'll send you the link for it. And I think maybe you can put it in the description or something and people can check it out.
We've covered a lot of ground. We've been very academic and theoretical, but I hope also material in our approach too, and people can understand that Cabral is not a man just of action, but also of thoughts as well, a massive intellectual who's influenced many people, all this while leading a successful anti-colonial struggle against the Portuguese. Is there anything else you want to add to the discussion? Anything that you feel like we missed out, or any sort of last words?
I mean, the only thing I would say is that I hope, you know, if people, you know, people listening to this would read Cabral himself, because his writings are much better than anything I write on him. I'm sure we'll be able to put up some links to some of his writings. So I hope people, you know, read it for themselves, and then we can have a discussion, whether, you know, by email, or they can tweet at us, as you mentioned. So that's all I have to say. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It was a really great conversation.
Of course, and hopefully I can have you back on so we can have that conversation of putting Walter Rodney and Cabral together in discussion and in conversation and sort of doing a compare and contrast type of discussion. I'm really looking forward to that as well.
Yes, I look forward to it. It would be fantastic, I'm sure.
All right, thank you for your time. And for those listening, make sure you subscribe or tweet at me or email me or whatever else you want to do to reach out to me and let me know how you enjoyed this episode. This has been another episode of the Groundings Podcast.
Like the coup d'etat in Ghana, when Nkrumah was deposed, like the terrible slaughter of the thousands of revolutionaries in Indonesia, the assassination of Cabral can only be a temporary defeat. And I think that any of you who would sit down and seriously study the international scene would see that today the trend of history is very clear. What happened on that day, on December 4th in the United Nations? What happened when the resolution in support of armed struggle against colonialism was passed? Was a mirror of the forces of history. There is no doubt about the fact that history has already sided with the forces of revolution, the forces of national liberation, the forces of socialism. And through the protests and battles of millions abroad and in this country as well, History has indicted imperialism. History has indicted U.S. imperialism and has already condemned it to its grave. The job of progressives and revolutionaries everywhere is to hasten the death of imperialism.